I didn't feel privileged to have been asked to be your chairman for this session. And I'd like to start the meeting by asking Nick to read how it works.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Nick, and I'm an alcoholic. Delighted to be here with all you people at this 36th annual conference of the IDAA. This is my third meeting. My first one was in Vancouver. At that time, I was a hopeless alcoholic. Finally felt I had some hope. For that, I'm very grateful. Ladies and gentlemen, I will read how it works from the big book. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed their path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose, in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, and you are ready to take certain steps. And some of these we bought. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery.
And start by asking John G. to share with us on step four. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And this, I believe, is the first step where we start to do some personal house cleaning. John, would you like to share?
Thank you, Elmer. My name is John Griswold, and I'm a drug addict and alcoholic from Washington, D.C. in suburban Maryland. About 6 months ago, John Butcher from Florida wrote to me and asked me if I would talk at this meeting on the fourth step, and I accepted because I learned 7 years ago in Morristown at the first IDA meeting that I went to, that if I came and I participated and I shared, I got better. And it's been very important for me to do that over this past 7 years. And that's why I come here today to do the same thing, even though it's difficult for me at this time because I'm very burdened and anxious about several things, mostly about Dolores, who is exceedingly ill and could not come today. I'm here to share, and I'm here to do what I said I would do, because I believe it's in my best interest, and I hope that it's may be of some value to you to see that a recovering drug addict can function without drugs, even in the face of a great deal of pain and a great deal of discomfort and a great deal of sleep deprivation. I've slept about 2 hours a night for about 2 weeks, and it's difficult to function. I've been running into amnesia, which in a lot of ways is very similar to the amnesia I used to have when I was taking tons of drugs. I remember going in and talking to my secretary in the office and saying, Jesus Christ, the worst thing about this business is a goddamn amnesia, you know, waking up after 3 or 4 days and not knowing what the hell day it was and not knowing what the date was and not knowing what patients were in the hospital and who'd come in and who'd gone home. And having to spend most of the first day after a binge or a drunk sorting things out and finding out what was what into play in terms of time, place, and person. The neat thing about the kind of amnesia I have now with my sleep deprivation, where I can't remember people's names that I should remember, is that when I get an hour or two sleep, then the amnesia goes away, which is just the reverse of the way it used to be 7 years ago when I took a few of these and a few of those and shot myself in the ass with a couple hundred milligrams of Demerol. I'd sleep pretty well for an hour, but when I woke up, I'd remember less than when I went to sleep. Elmer asked us to say a little bit about how we got into AA. And my story is one of about 21 years of drug addiction with a early crash after 7 years and a late crash the last 7 years, with 7 years in between of kind of falling upstairs. I got into drugs beginning with dexedrine in medical school at Columbia in New York City in 1952, and gradually increased the use of drugs and the number of drugs, using uppers, downers, progressively, and becoming more and more dependent upon them. Going on into the Army after a straight surgical internship up in New York at Cornell and getting a surgical residency at Walter Reed, and getting in a great deal of trouble, not so much because I did not do adequate work. I believe my work was adequate, but my judgment was extremely bad in terms of how to get along with other people, and I offended a number of people because I had no fear because I was continually drugged. And I got some adverse ratings, and I ended up, my first hospitalization in 1958 was 3 weeks on the on the note ward at Walter Reed, where I got 7 shock treatments because I had to tell them at that time I was depressed, which I was, because drug addiction, alcoholism was a disciplinary thing back in 1958 and was not an illness, and it was hard to cope with. And the shock treatments did nothing for my addiction, but they did cure my insomnia. But when I got over that, I got out of there. I had to take some more, a little bit extra cocaine and a little bit extra dexedrine to get my mind turning, because the shock treatments fuzzed it up. My first crash terminated 1962. They took away my surgical residency at the end of the third year, although they did not invite me to leave the Army. And at that time, I had no power to accept what I could not change. My wife and I took a 10-day leave up in a house we had out at the end of Long Island. And I remember pacing around up there. I came up and put my hand behind the back of her neck, telling her to please get off her ass and get busy, because we had things to do. There really was nothing to do. And when I looked down at my hand, it was full of her hair, and she looked like she'd been scalped by an Apache Indian. I threw the hair in the incinerator. I didn't know what to do about her. So I took about 3 Seconal, went to sleep for a couple of hours, and when I woke up, she was gone. The 2 children were gone. And within 10 days in 1960, I had lost my surgical career, which was very precious to me, and I had lost my wife and family. And I had a great deal of trouble coping with that. And what happened very briefly was I ended up in a psychiatric hospital in White Plains, New York, for 6 months in 1962, doing milieu therapy, where I made moccasins and played golf and stuff like that. And that was kind of fun. It was kind of like going back to prep school in a way. But I only lasted 13 days before I found I was depressed, because being away 6 months was your basic resume buster. I couldn't explain that, so I had to take a lot of drugs to get functioning and get over the depression, and now having that stigma on top of the other stigmas. I followed that by the one thing I did get out of that was I was very careful with drugs for about 7 years and kind of fell up stairs, as we say in AA. I came back, having screwed up in New York, I came back to Washington and built up a practice down here. Did very well for about 7 years, but the last 7 years I went on downhill again. During all this time, I had a lot of attention from board-certified, university-affiliated psychiatrists. There was a guy I went to see twice a week down on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C., and I had convulsions on Quaalude, so he told me I should change to Placidil. I had hallucinations, and I did things like fall downstairs in my house and break my teeth and break my ribs, and you know, that kind of thing doesn't happen anymore, but that's what was going on in the last 7 years. The very last year, I was sure I was going to lose my license. I went to talk to the psychiatrist I've been talking to for 15 years. He told me to get out of his office. I was bad for his reputation because I'd gotten him to write letters to Sibley Hospital for me saying that he was treating me and I was doing well and I would get better. And, of course, I didn't get better. I got worse. And the people in D.C. started to get a little bit annoyed with him. So my psychiatrist fired me, and I didn't know what to do. I spent a little bit of time talking to the, although I had no sympathy for their position. I had been trained as a combat surgeon with the 82nd Airborne, and I talked to the South African ambassador, and I talked to the Rhodesian information officer, and applied for positions there because I was sure I was going to be persona non grata very shortly around Washington. What I was doing in Washington that last spring and summer, 1978, was spending 4 days out of five at home in my house in Bethesda trying to get some rest, because I needed rest. And I would take three or four Placidil, and that usually didn't put me to sleep, so I'd go to toddle downstairs and get a big tumbler of white wine, because I like that, but that usually wouldn't put me to sleep. So I'd shoot myself in the rear end with a couple hundred milligrams of Demerol, and that would usually put me to sleep for about an hour, and then I'd wake up and do it again. And that's what I did 4 days out of five. And my mother, who was still living at that time, my busybody's sister and her husband, thought this was not exactly healthy, acceptable behavior. And they were planning to commit me to Chestnut Lodge, which is a psychiatric hospital in Rockville in Montgomery County, Maryland. I didn't want any part of that because I'd spent 6 months in a nut house up in New York, and that didn't do any good. I didn't know what the hell to do. I thought of going to South Africa, as I mentioned. One thing I did very quickly was I figured I better get a next of kin over whom I had some control. So I took my number one girlfriend out to the courthouse in Maryland and married her on the 14th of February. 1978, and that's how I became married to Dolores, who many of you know. because I wanted to avoid going to Chestnut Lodge for 2 years, and I wanted to avoid, my family was planning to sell my house, sell my car, liquidate everything I owned, put me in debt into the bargain. I wanted to avoid all that. I asked if there wasn't some way to avoid that, and the guy at Chestnut Lodge was kind enough and honest enough to say he thought he knew somebody who did that kind of work, and he gave me the name of Dr. Chambers, who was talking about going to detox in 28 days, and I thought that was a good deal compared to 2 years in the nut farm for $150,000 that I didn't have. So anyhow, I did that, and very briefly, that's how I came into AA. I went to detox, I went to Seneca, and I've been in AA and sober for 7 years now. I'm supposed to talk about the fourth step, and I will try to do that very quickly. I think all of us know the fourth step, which is to make a fearless and searching inventory of ourselves. One of my character defects is laziness, and I tend to want a prepared menu. I'm lazy. I don't like to sit down and think. And where I got my menu for the fourth step was over in the grounds of Washington Cathedral in Satterley Hall. And for about 2 or 3 months, I stayed the hell away from the Northwest Washington suburban Maryland area and went to meetings, 20 miles away, because I didn't want to run into anybody that I knew, because they might think I was a drug addict, But after about 3 months, it was suggested to me that I go to some meetings nearby, and I went over to St. Albans, and there was a meeting on the fourth step, and Walter Helmick was there. I don't mean to break his anonymity, but he's not anonymous. He was the chief of anesthesiology at Sibley Hospital. I sort of got that feeling that I got when I first came in. Jesus, if the chief of a service at the hospital I work can be here, maybe it's okay for me to be here too. And he was talking a lot about the one of his character defects of self-reliance. And that didn't make any sense to me, because like many American boys, I'd been brought up to be self-reliant. And that didn't make any sense to me at that time, but it makes a lot of sense to me now, because a lot of the burdens and problems I have now with Dolores' illness and with my career are really things that I can't handle. I just have to do what I can do and turn them over to God. Up on the wall of Satterley Hall there was a list of character defects, and I'll just read them to you quickly. And then I'm going to just talk briefly about some of my character defects and how I'm coping with them today. The list on the wall there included dishonesty, selfishness, resentment, egotism, fear, anger, hatred, false pride, self-seeking, conceit, intolerance, envy, bigotry, laziness, frustration, impatience, jealousy, arrogance, condemnation, inadequacy, remorse, self-pity, worry, anxiety, uncharitableness, and self-reliance. And I'll just talk about a few of those that I have that I'm trying to cope with today and trying to handle and trying to be free of. I guess the most heavy burden, I have right now is Dolores' illness. As many of you know, she was operated on May 10th, 1984, and found to have disseminated carcinosarcoma. She got 5 months of heavy chemotherapy. We checked with Memorial. We went up to Memorial Hospital in New York. We checked with MD Anderson in Houston, NIH, Johns Hopkins, a couple other places. None of those places had a case similar to hers, which survived 1 year, regardless of what was done. So it was pretty obvious that Western medicine had nothing to offer her, and she decided on her own to terminate her chemotherapy and go on a macrobiotic diet, which at that time I thought didn't make any goddamn sense, but it was at least harmless, just a good peasant diet. And I didn't believe it at all, but she believed it. And I remember her last October in Mystic talking about how grateful she was and how the best was yet to come. And when I got up to talk, my voice broke when I talked about her illness. But she, in her own peaceful, serene way, talked very positively. And in October, she believed it and I didn't. But she went on this diet and she got better. And about 3 months ago, there was no evidence of disease. Her CAT scan was negative. Her blood tests were negative. And she was doing very, very well. I remember talking in Morristown in April, just roughly 2 months ago. I got up and talked because I knew it was necessary for me to share and participate, and I talked about how we had a higher power, and I had begun to believe that Dolores would be all right, and I did believe it then. And I remember sitting with Conway and Charlotte, and Dolores was eating her diet up there, cooking it in her room. And I had a great deal of belief, and it was very positive. I remember standing up in the Century Club in New York City in May at the 30th reunion of my medical school class and telling the other guys there what we were doing and how I sincerely believed there was something to it and that it seemed to be working for Dolores as it was working for other people whom we know very well and been in contact with. But over the past 4 to 6 months have been signs of trouble, and 2 weeks we went down to Bermuda. We were very lucky, and I'm grateful for it. We went to Bermuda for a week over the 4th of July, and it was kind of neat because we'd all gone, the whole family had gone in July of 1984 because it was to be Dolores' last trip, and here she was in good health in July of 1985, or seemingly in good health. And we're getting to go again, and everything went fine up until the last day or two when she began to develop pain and swelling in the upper extremities. She came back from Bermuda, was examined. The orthopedic surgeon who saw her could find nothing wrong, but I couldn't quite understand why she had all these signs and symptoms in her upper extremities. Although her x-rays were negative, we did not do a bone scan. She got examined 2 weeks ago by the guy who operated on her. He felt a mass, and we did a CAT scan, and she has large 5-centimeter masses throughout the pelvis and the lower abdomen. And what she's going to do about that is tighten up her diet, and she's going up to Philadelphia and kind of go whole hog on it. She's very positive, and she's handling this very well. She handles it a lot better than I do because, you know, she still believes, and I'm kind of back to where I was a year ago. I'm very skeptical. I believe there's something in it because we've seen a number of cases who have been rather miraculous, but it does not seem to be working for her at this time. So I'm going through all the emotions I went through a year ago, all the fear and the anger and the self-pity and the worry and the anxiety. It's very hard for me to handle. I have a lot of resentments that this goddamn disease has come back, that there's been a lot of stress on us the past few months due to changes in my practice. And it's very easy for me to be resentful that the stress has been imposed upon us at this time. There is a fair amount of evidence in the literature that your T cells work better when you're free of stress, and we've had our plate full of stress over the past few months. But I've learned in this program that you really have to deal with the cards that are dealt to you. And there's really no benefit to me wasting my time and energy being angry and resentful. But these are feelings I have. They're tied up with normal grief, but they stand up very sharply as my character defects that I have to handle and try to put aside. But it's very much like a year ago when we were out in Minnesota at that very nice meeting that you guys from Minnesota put on, and I drove Dolores down to the College of St. Teresa in Winona, where she'd been to school, and we spent the day down there, and I found myself crying a number of occasions during that day because I knew Dolores had been a very special person, a special graduate of that of that college. I never realized quite how superior she was. She was far away, number one in her class, and over a period of years, and she had gotten her own education and gone on to work at the State Department and become become chief of current intelligence. But I found myself crying and talking to one of the old sisters there who had been there when Dolores had been there, and talking about making plans to give them enough money for a scholarship in her memory. But these are some of the defects that I have to deal with. Some of it, as I say, is normal grief, but a lot of it is self-pity. You know, that perhaps I'm crying for myself, which I consider a defect. When you stop and think about it, the threats of my career, which I'm not going to go into, but which I can handle, I turn it over to two good attorneys, and they will do very well with it, and I don't have to worry about it. A lot of the pain that I have probably comes down to self-pity, because in a way I'm a lot better off than I was in 1960 when I lost everything and ended up with nothing. A lot of the feelings I have are similar to the feelings I had then, but there's one hell of a big difference, and that is that I'm sober and I'm able to work my program and I'm able to defend myself, and I didn't know what the hell's going to happen. Dolores and I talked about, you know, if there was any purpose in this recurrence that had come up within the past month or two. And Dolores, thinking positively, thought, well, now, you know, if it works when she tightens it up, nobody can say, as many people have said, that obviously the chemotherapy had done in her carcinosarcoma, because now we have documented verifiable recurrence. And if by some slight chance in hell it goes away again, why, it's not due to chemotherapy. And then Dolores also suggested that maybe God wants us to do better, and I'm willing to do better, and I'm willing to continue to work my program and do what I can to be useful. And I came here to Savannah because this is very important to me, to my recovery and to my good health. And the way I handle these defects of character is just the way that that other people handle them. The primary thing is I'm sober. I have to use the third step a great deal. You know, in the last analysis, although I'm in a way like the children of alcoholics that Bill McKenzie was talking about yesterday, I feel that I should be doing things. I feel guilty or bothered because I haven't done some things or I can't do some things. There really isn't a hell of a lot I can do. Dolores is a very strong person and makes her own decisions. It really doesn't have anything to do with me. So I use my third step and I try to live one day at a time and try to be grateful for what I have. In a way, I'm a lot better off than I was 7 years ago. I'm a lot better off than I was in 1960 when I lost both career and family, because this time I'm going to cope and I'm going to be all right, and I'm not going to end up in a nut house in White Plains, New York, making moccasins for 6 months. I'd like to wind this up, and I'm sorry I've gone over my time, by reading one of my favorite passages from the 24-hour book, which gives me a lot of comfort. It's from February 1st, and the meditation for the day is, I will start a new life each day. I will put the old mistakes away and start anew each day. God always offers me a fresh start. I will not be burdened or anxious. If God's forgiveness were only for the righteous and those who had not sinned, where would be its need? I believe that God forgives us all of our sins if we're honestly trying to live today the way He wants us to live. God forgives us much, and we should be very grateful. And the prayer for the day is, I pray that my life may not be spoiled by worry and fear and selfishness. I pray that I may have a glad, thankful, and humble heart. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. This program is a language of the heart, and I appreciate very much the depth of your sharing, John. I, too, have trouble sometimes wondering what why these things come along in my life, and I'm sure as you are right now. But with prayer, I always feel that something, the answers come if I only wait for them, and sometimes they seem to be a long time in coming, but they do come. So thanks again, John. Our next speaker is Walter H. from Florida, who's going to share his thoughts on step 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Walter?
Thank you, Elmer. Thank you, everyone. My name is Walter, and I'm an alcoholic. My thoughts and prayers will be with you and Dolores, John. I'm a lot better than I used to be. I'm a lot better than I used to be because of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm very grateful for every one of the meetings I've ever attended. I've needed all of them, and I'm very grateful for every person like yourself who has been in the meetings when I've gone. God and the fellowship and the eyeball-to-eyeball meetings and sharing in these meeting rooms is what seems to give us the answers to all the things we have to face. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs is what step 5 says. But before I share a little bit with you some of my feelings about that step, I can remember my sponsor, one of my sponsors. I had several sponsors in the course of my recovery, and my recovery is now fortunate enough to be longer than my drinking career. My sponsor, the first one I ever had back in Ohio, was telling me that the 12 steps is a package deal. And so it's assumed that I have already been familiar with step 1, 2, 3, and 4 before I try number 5. And I found out later down in Florida when I tried to take step number 5 with an older member of our AA group that, in fact, I wasn't where I thought I was. I'm a colorectal surgeon in Florida, and really didn't have too much trouble with alcohol until I got into the Navy, as I see it now. I graduated from Ohio State. We had some drinking bouts during medical school, certainly, but I don't remember any difficulty with them. But when I entered the Navy, I had more time, and I had more money, and there was more alcohol available. Alcohol was available for everything. And it was natural for everybody to drink, but it wasn't very long before I discovered that. And I was using far more alcohol than was good for me, and continued to be that way until I was forced into some kind of recovery. That drinking career only covered a fairly short period of time, though, basically 1961, until I was first confronted and forced into doing something about my drinking in 1966. During those years, and then when I finally got the program, apparently soundly, in 1968, I had almost been thrown out of two residencies, one the surgical training that precedes specialty training, and then the specialty training. I nearly got thrown out of both of those for drinking. I thought I was hiding it, of course, and I thought it wasn't detectable. And yet the nurses could detect it easily, and the excuses that I would come up with later, and the functions and the duties and responsibilities that I would miss because of drinking, made it clear that I had a problem and I was called on the carpet. By that time in Michigan, I can remember I was drinking enough and having enough problem that I couldn't remember the last 30 minutes of the surgical procedure, having done it. Couldn't remember the last half of the AP resection. And, of course, could not remember where my car was. And it was very clear that I had become preoccupied with alcohol and had lost complete control in its use. I used it morning, noon, and night, and it didn't matter whether I was on call, didn't matter whether I had surgery. I couldn't control it. And it finally, of course, backfired on me, and it became evident when I passed out in the surgeon's lounge before helping the chief on a case at 1:30 in the afternoon. So they said, you're going to have to do something about your drinking. And I didn't know what to do at that time. I didn't know about AA. I remember the medical officer I was in the Navy with. He was in practice in New York State at that time, and he was a close friend, and I called him, and he said, you know, Walt, I'm not surprised I'm getting this phone call. He was an internist in Elmira, New York, and he said, just so happens that I'm on the alcoholism control board here in Elmira, and I can tell you now that we don't have too much scientifically to offer you in the medical profession, but he said, I'll have somebody get in touch with you from AA. And so they certainly did. They called on my residence in Michigan where I was doing the specialty training, and I went into AA for the first time May 23rd, 1966 in Grand Rapids. I remember that. But that wasn't enough because I drank again after that, stopped again, drank again, and then stopped again, finally in February 1968. And it's taken me every meeting I've gone to up to now to get where I am and every one of you people to help. I've got a freedom now so that, in fact, such a freedom that I do not have to drink. At one time, I had to drink. It was very unnatural. It was very natural for me to be intoxicated all the time, 24 hours a day. And now it would be very unnatural for me to take a drink. But only through the fellowship and only through this program and only through the steps have I been able to reach that point. And I'm very grateful for every one of the people along the way who've been so helpful to me. I see many of them in the room right at this moment. Step 5 says that we admitted to God and to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Well, it also says in the 12 and 12 that this is against our normal nature to have to do these kinds of things. And so that's maybe one reason why it was successful. If we were fairly careful and very complete about the fourth step, and we have at least I had a tendency to overdo the negative portions of my inventory. And if it weren't for a sponsor telling me that I was being too hard on myself, I think we have a tendency to overdo the negative parts of our inventories and don't see the affirmative parts of our persons. But at least we had been able to admit, if we went through the fourth step fairly reasonably, that we certainly had a period of wrong thinking and wrong acting that had hurt ourselves and others. And the AA experience tells us that we can't deal with these things by ourselves. And in fact, the talk yesterday about the adult children of alcoholics was very instructive to me because I have a tendency to be introspective and looking for all kinds of insight. And we learned yesterday that in codependency, and in fact in dependency, insight is not curative. So I can do all kinds of thinking and make all kinds of lists and review all kinds of programs and obtain all kinds of insight, but it's not curative. The therapy and the treatment is and the willingness to actually do these fifth steps and go to the trouble of finding someone to go to and talk to him about these things is what becomes curative. I have a tendency as a surgeon to think that if I carry out certain steps, then certain things will follow. Well, that's true, generally speaking, but we all know that the same things don't always follow. We can carry out exactly the same procedure and two different things happen. So if we carry out some of these steps, we still don't have a secure recovery or a secure result until we get some help and get some help from outside of ourselves. And this is what step five suggests that we do. We get some help outside of ourselves because, in fact, in my case, my thinking was so muddled and so confused and so fearful and full of so much resentment and self-pity and full of so much guilt and shame that I couldn't possibly think straight. And couldn't possibly review myself very carefully, or very honestly at least, or very appropriately even, without someone's else's help. I could review myself, but I couldn't get meaning from it unless I shared it with someone else who then could help me get that meaning. I'd have a tendency to continue if I did not take the step, and if I did not go to the trouble of finding the person and sharing with them, then I would continue to exaggerate, and I would continue to fall into all the kinds of traps that I used to fall into myself and create for myself, and all the kinds of smoke screens that I would throw up, thinking that I was right. But sharing it and getting some outside help from our program and from our higher power, which I choose to call God, is what is, in fact, to me, been the most helpful and the most pivotal in my recovery. I took the fifth step twice. The first we have in Florida outside of Tampa, there's a spiritual retreat we've had for a number of years, I think 17 or 18 years now, at St. Leo College. And it's a retreat confined to steps 3, 11, and 12. And I've gone to that for a number of years. And maybe 9 years ago or 10 years ago, I took it upon myself because the man made an impression on me to call the president of St. Leo College, who was the abbot, and ask him if he could meet me Saturday morning to take a fifth step. And I had no expectation that he would be busy or tied up or otherwise occupied. And I just felt that he probably would be able to do it. And I was shocked to hell to find out that, in fact, he was. And he was able to meet at 11 o'clock Saturday morning. So I drove back to St. Leo and met with him, and he'd known through these retreats a lot about AA and a lot about alcoholics. But as I look back on it now, I don't know whether he had had anybody come to him with fifth steps that often. But nevertheless, I did that, and I achieved something from that. Now, as I look back later on, I still had some of my same muddled thinking and still some of the same alcoholic characteristics that we carry with us, even in recovery. And my own sponsor then back in St. Petersburg said that he thought maybe I should go back through step four again. And so I did that with his help. And then I took several months trying to find an individual that I felt comfortable with and I felt trusting of in the program in St. Peter, Clearwater area that I could take the fifth step with again. And I finally found that gentleman, an old-timer in the program. He was in the, I think he was just 80 years old at that time, and had been in the program for more than 20 years. And as opposed to some of my friends in AA who had not been that careful about choosing their fifth step person and had gone to a town 100 miles away and had taken potluck, so to speak, with a priest in that kind of town so that they wouldn't be sharing their stories with anybody that was anywhere close to them. I chose not to do that. I had seen this older timer in meetings in Clearwater and St. Pete for years, and I knew he had done lots of helping for lots of people, and I asked him if he would help me with my fifth step, and he agreed. So I went to his little apartment, and I had all my legal pads spread out on his couch there. We were ready to start the fifth step, and we'd been talking about 2 minutes. And he said, "Walter, wait just a minute. I know why you've come here. You called me, and you told me why you were coming. I see all your sheets over there on the couch. Very nice on your step four. But don't you think we ought to go back one?" And I did not know what he meant in the slightest, but he pointed out to me in that hour meeting that I, in fact, hadn't been very comfortable and straightforward with step three. And he thought that's where we should start. So we finished step three in that hour. And then over the next 7 weeks, as it turns out, the way I chose to do it and the way he chose to advise me, I went back and forth to his little apartment, and we finished, in fact, step five. So I had that, very importantly, that outside help, which straightened out to get out of that theory and be willing to share with God and with someone else the nature of my wrongs. And then also, as I've discovered in my recovery, and as the book says, and it helps me explain some of the things that I could otherwise not explain, the grace of God is able to enter me and expel some of these awful obsessions that were once part of my personality. For that, I'm exceedingly grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Walter. I'm always delighted to hear someone who follows the program and is so committed to it. And I really like what you said, Walter, and appreciate it. Thank you. There's a slight change in the speakers. Step six. We're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. We are going to have John from Oklahoma share his thoughts on that. John?
I'm John Eichen, a real alcoholic. I say a real alcoholic because the big book tells me what a real alcoholic is, and I didn't know for a lot of years, and alcohol did everything for me. I didn't need any other drugs. My second life started June the 24th, 1980. I want to thank a lot of people in here. I've made some of these meetings since then, and a lot of them, I guess. And due to a lot of miracles in my life, I'm here today. And one of my defects of character when I first came was I sat in the back of the room, and there was no way anybody could get me to come up here. But this morning I was asked if I'd fill in, and I could say yes, and that's one of the benefits of this program. I said my second life started that date. My first life started in October 29th, 1932. And the coincidence was I was one of those babies that was born that wouldn't start breathing, and I think God was gave me a second chance then after all efforts failed. A surgeon there at home that delivered me took a needle out and stuck a needle in my heart and gave me a shot of something, and I suppose adrenaline or something. Anyway, I started in this life, and that was kind of, my life's been miracles ever since. And this morning, someone shared their wrecks and everything, you know. When I was in a treatment center, they read that Footprints on the Sand, and I don't know if I saw all these visions or what, but my whole life went in front of me, and I cried for the first time because God had carried me through 47 years and 8 months of my life. But to tell a little bit about how I got here, briefly, we're running a little short of time, but I was the little kid that the family had alcohol in the house, and it was free around, and I drank it, I snuck it, and I liked what it did for me, and I, as a real small kid, I mean 4 or 5 years old, got enough to go to sleep on. I wouldn't call, might even been passing out, I don't know. They couldn't find me for a while every once in a while. And on, even we had the keg wine, and when I'd go back down to the barn to feed the calves, I'd get the hose out and sip on that keg of wine, and at times I couldn't get back to the house. You know, this was in grade school. So this disease, I think some of us are really born with it, and for me, the first time I drank, I liked what it did. I was in trouble in high school. I was, an easy student. I made any grade I wanted to make, and I didn't care as long. I'd rather be with the crowd than make a better grade, yet I still did all right. But we drank beer most every day in high school, and on weekends we got the whiskey out and went out with the big people. And I don't know, the laws were a hell of a lot more tolerant then. But I went on to college, and here again the wreck started happening, and then I was in trouble. They threw my buddy out of college, and I knew I was right next to him. But for a lot of prayer, I did at that time have God in my life, and I knew I needed Him, and I was young in my class, and I needed all the help I can get, and I was going to daily mass and trying everything, you know. I got out of college, and I was 23, and I had to go to the Army, which I had to wait a while to do that, so I worked at the stockyards. I'm a veterinarian, by the way, and I graduated from Oklahoma A&M College. At the stockyards, it was the same thing. You know, all my life has been turmoil. I always was expected to do more, and I didn't feel I could handle it. And it took alcohol to put me where I needed to be and to do what I needed to do. I went on to the Army then, and here again, I was put into situations. A ship went by the other night, and they were shipping me overseas, and I was supposed to fly over, and they called my name, and they made me troop commander, 2,200 troops. And here I am, a veterinarian, and had 2 years ROTC, and you know, I had to act like hell to pull that deal off, and so that's about the way I lived. You know, hell, my life was. Someone else was talking about as a veterinarian. You know, I had to fake a lot of things. I didn't know what I was doing a lot of times because they call it practice, and that's what I did had to do because we're expected to know everything, and you know, we don't tell anybody. You know, the farmers are out there looking you over. They think you know, and they want to check you out. So my whole life was a hell of a life of turmoil. And in this mess, I got married and right before I went overseas, and we had an 18-month honeymoon. It wasn't all wasted, I guess. And anyway, I came back and started practice on my own, and here again, it was stress and strain, but the only quiet time I had in my life when I was totally mortgaged and working like hell and had 5 little kids. At that time, I just partied on holidays and stuff, and stayed out of trouble for a little while, but then the money started coming in, the success started coming in, and John retired partially. I got 3 partners, and I, you know, success was rampant. I had the best practice in Oklahoma. I say had real loud. God removed some of the things I couldn't handle. I can laugh about that today and drive by it, and I'll tell you about that. Anyway, from 1963 to 1973, just kind of a flash, you know. I'd have to think about what color car we had to tell you what year it was. But I was really living it up. I was on a city council and building the jail that I was in to end up in. And but in 1973, God kind of tried to get my attention. I had a head-on crash, and two other people were injured, and I was injured too, but I wouldn't even go to the doctor, and the pickup burned, and yeah, and they filed charges. And the worst part was my lawyer friend tried to keep it out of the paper, and the newspaper, since I was on city council, gave me a public trial on the paper, pictures and everything, and my wife and five kids had to go through all that turmoil, and all I could do was drink and say, you know, I'm not hurting anybody. They just don't understand. It was just an accident, and I had excuses for all this stuff, but they sent me to drunk driving school, and I didn't learn anything there either except don't drink and don't drive. On the way to drunk driving school, on the way back, I'd get me a six-pack because I was tired. But, you know, I was getting scared then. I knew I wouldn't, anything that said alcoholic on, I'd turn the radio off. Or didn't want to hear about that. And the judge had told me, everybody had told me, you got to do something about your drinking. When I was 40, they quit selling me insurance because of high blood pressure. And the doctor said, you better watch it. And hell, I kept watching it, you know. So finally, in 1977, after a lot of hell, I gave up my practice. I thought, all that damn stress and stuff, if I get rid of that, maybe I could survive. So I went on a 10-month vacation, and I had some money saved up, and I already knew that I was burning out. I'd had a lot of hemorrhages, a lot of other physical problems, and I was satisfied just to die and get it over with, and that wasn't happening fast enough. And at that point, God gave me an opportunity to try again. I got a job as a federal veterinarian in meat inspection. And damn, they worked the hell out of me for a couple of years. And I couldn't drink before I went to work, but I drank the minute I left that plant. I had to have ice water and a drink because you worked as I did, you enjoyed it, or you needed it. But getting down to 1980, January, I'll tell this real quick because some of the people in here may have gone through this thing. And my wife had, she had a lot more trouble. I said she had more trouble than I had. She took those damn pills for 10 years, laid around the house, and here I was helping take care of the kids, so I couldn't be as bad as she was. But she had gone to AA and gotten sober and had one of the blue books around the house, and she'd talked to a doctor, and she and five kids decided they were going to take care of Dad, and I needed it. I can't deny that, but I didn't appreciate the way they did it. That is one of the things they call interventions in a doctor's office. And I sat here and went through an intervention lecture, and I can tell them all the things I did wrong, but I don't. There's no wrong intervention, even if the man blows his brains out. At least he's going to die that way anyway. He might as well, you know. But for me, I didn't. I wouldn't go. Everything went fine except I got up and walked out and said, "To hell with all of it," because I could not see living without alcohol. I tried alcohol. There wasn't an answer. They didn't give me a. What are you going to do without it? But 6 months later, I came to that point I was telling you about at the beginning of my second life. I got to a point of suicide, and lucky it didn't happen. I called a treatment center and said, I'm coming in, and on a Friday night I crawled in, and that was the beginning of the next Tuesday. I drove through town and didn't buy that bottle. It was my beginning of my second life. But from that time on, it's just been miracles, and I don't want to run over any more time here, but these things, it all comes back to the work in these steps in this program. You know, the surrender is the hardest, and it took me a long damn time. And I don't know, but I didn't do it. I'll have to say that. The day before it happened, I wasn't any different. I was still willing to go on and on and on. But something happened that night after that suicide thing that God said, you know, this is about the last chance I'm giving you, friend. And I think that's what got my, I gave up and said, I got to do something. I knew that there was something, another way out by then. But the sixth step says that we become willing, and all the things I told you about made me willing as hell. When I went to that treatment center, I didn't ask any questions. I wasn't any better, and every person in there was put there just for me. There was somebody there that I needed to know about. And while I was there, and I'll share this because the fifth step was just mentioned, I'd taken the first three steps of this program without even knowing what the program was, because I'd gotten everything that they said that was required there in these steps when I finally found out what they were. But the main thing, I knew that I couldn't stay sober unless I got right with God. So about the third day there, I went over to this priest and started talking to him about getting my spiritual life straightened out. And this gave me an enthusiasm to, after I found out what the fourth step was, to start working on that. Now, this, where I went, didn't make any provision for anybody working any steps past the first three. They tried to work you into those, but I knew I couldn't stay sober feeling the way I felt. So on my own, I was working on this four-step, and the day before I left, I knew now was the time, and had the opportunity to finish that the fifth step with the same priest because I had started with. But getting back to the sixth step, after I had taken my fifth step, I did what Big Book said. I went back and I looked at it all over again and reevaluated what had happened. And I was willing as hell because I didn't want to drink again. And this program gets better. They tell you keep coming back, it'll get better. And what gets better is your vision of these steps, you know. There's 200 words in those steps, and no one will fully ever understand and quit getting something out of them. So my first attempt at the sixth step was all only defective character. I asked God, and I was willing for everything, but if he would just help me never to drink again, to help me to remove that compulsion that I knew that I couldn't leave there. I couldn't stay sober if I felt the way I felt when I went in there. I didn't have that faith yet that I could do that. So this was the only defective character that I asked about. And the amazing thing was I left that treatment center and I've never had any type of desire to drink. So this thing works. So as I was going to meetings, and the seventh step is the reason it works. You have to do that too, but you have to become willing. But as I went on to meetings then, and I'm one of those that had, God gave me an opportunity. I don't think if I'd had any full-time job, but I was the job I had, I could slip off, stop at a meeting, and keep going, you know. And so the job God had given me 2 years before was just made for recovering veterinarian that couldn't do anything else. Mentally and physically, I was just hanging on. But these other defects of character, this practice I was telling you about, you know, I couldn't stay sober if I couldn't get rid of all the hate and envy and all those other things that I had of these partners and this whole thing. I knew that I have to drive by that place and have to go back there. So after the fear of the drinking left, I knew I had to start working on these other things that I had found in my fourth and fifth step. So I worked at them one at a time. It says all. I think we're willing for all, but for me, it's a process. And as each time I hurt, pain is a great motivator. Each time I get to something that I know is not letting me be comfortable, I start working on that one. But today, I can drive by my clinic, the one I built, the new clinic, the one I paid for and gave away, and have no feelings of any, you know, and this is the freedom they talk about in this program. You can laugh about it. I think I look at it now as I was freed from all that, you know. And the main thing, the only reason I needed that clinic was financial. I didn't like what I was doing after the last few years because it was just, it really wasn't physically and mentally able. One of the partners I had, I got because I couldn't do surgery anymore. I was shaking so bad. So what the final message is that miracles happen when you surrender. They've happened for me, and I just have to look over at Conway and tell you this, because the first conference I went to was in October 1980, and Conway spoke in Amarillo, Texas, and he probably doesn't know why he was there, but he was there for me. He came by my room and he said, "You might want to come to CCAD meeting." He gave me a thing, and I said, "Hell, I've never been to Atlanta, never wanted to go, and I'll never be there." But I kept it. And at first meeting, when it came around time, something told me to come on by there. And here's where I started meeting new people. So the other defects of character, I don't want to go down the whole list, but the whole theory is when you're willing, and you got to be willing for the whole thing. You got to have that 180 degree turnaround in your life. You got to get those old places, those old things. You got to be willing just to turn your whole life around. And when I was laying in that hospital and looked at everything I knew and everything I'd done, and that's where it got me, laying on that bed. And the best part was that was the first time in my life I'd ever been in a hospital, even though I could tell you for hours about tragedies and wrecks and things. But here I am, and it works, and I hope it helps you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. I identify a lot with your story, the willingness and the freedom. And I was an anesthesiologist, which is something I don't practice today and haven't for 8.5 years. And the willingness to give that up in a way that God designed it to, I have a freedom from that too. Step 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, will be discussed by Marcus? I'd like to share with us, please.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mark Cox. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I first attended IDAA in Cleveland some 5 years ago, and just recovering from a colon put back in that God had removed from me due to a little tequila. And they called on all the new members to give a little bit of step one, and I was scared, paralyzed with fear, self-centered fear, when I was rudely kicked out of my chair by God, Geraldine O'Delaney. So in my newfound fervor, I merely stood up, scared to death, and I said, I'm Mark Cox. I'm an alcoholic. I drank enough booze to bust a gut, and that's why I'm here. And indeed, I did. My drinking story started right here in this state. I'm a native of a little town called Tifton, Georgia. Very good Baptist country. I had no God in my life at all. My grandfather was a Baptist minister, lived with us, and he sat there with a stern look and a little beard and steel blue eyes, read the Bible all the time, and I was scared to hell out of even thinking about a God, if that's what that transformed people into. I had no alcohol in the family that I could relate to, and I went at a very early age, at like 15, to the University of Georgia, where I had my first experience with alcohol, being initiated into my college fraternity. I'm a Sig Alpha, and that seems to be almost a requirement in Georgia. But we had kegs and kegs of beer at initiation. They had big paddles. They had a fire bell. They set little fires all over the campus. The pledges were forced to chug-a-lug, 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 chug-a-lug the beer. Fire bell would ring, and you had to go put out the fires. You men know how we had to put out the fires. Well, the beer put me out. I'll never forget that giddy, sinking, dizzy, pukey feeling as I went out. The next day, couldn't get up to go to school or anything. I'd always been a loner, a super achiever, probably the son of an alcoholic, because none of the six boys could ever do enough to please him. But the next day, for the first time in my life, I felt acceptance when all the guys said, oh God, Mark, you drank so much beer and you put out so many fires. You peed further than anyone else. And that began my drinking career. The service accelerated it very nicely, a little 90-day wonder. Immediately got under a drunk general and a drunk master sergeant, and it was a hell of a war we fought in the Pacific. The general drank, I drank, the first sergeant drank, and every August 18th, I wrote myself a promotion and a glowing recommendation. The first sergeant typed it, and the general signed it, and the war went very peacefully in the Pacific. But this was the beginning of disaster. In all my life, I had never known humility because I did not know God. We learn in this program at step one, if we take it perfectly, and it's the only one we have to take perfectly, leads us into humility. This I had none. I had nothing in my life always except excitement, depression, grief, anxiety, which it tells us in the seventh step. That's one of our problems. That's our big problem, is self-motivated, self-centered fear. Prior to coming in this program, my life was really more excitement. You know, we're the most interesting damn people in the world, we survivors. Crazy things. Excitement, then depression. went through two wives rapidly, gained four kids by one, adopted three by another. Now I've done it again and got four more. You know, we alcoholics just don't lie down and take things like most. 11 kids. My own four are all chemically dependent. Out of the three I adopted, two out of three are chemically dependent. The one that isn't is the dull one. He's a doctor. But we are interesting people. Our big problem is lack of power. We are powerless. It tells us that in the first step. It tells us that in the second step. It tells us that in the 11th step. But in the 11th step is when we seek through daily prayer and meditation to form a more conscious contact of this God of our understanding, praying for knowledge of His will for us today and the power to carry that out. And there we get it back. But this 7th step is, it's a lulu. My wife has been waiting for weeks for me to discuss humility. And I have it for a while, and then I give it away, and then it's lost a while, and then I get it again, and this old excitement still comes in my life. I think one of the greatest things that ever happened to me really was in my depression stages after being divorced twice and finally building a bachelor's pad, and all four of my little chemically addicted kids said, "Dada, we want to live with you." Well, hell, they were already addicts and teenagers, and so that was a hell of an arrangement, but I'd get depressed over my antics or theirs, and I'd buy a new car. It always solved my depression. So when I finally surrendered, living alone, I had six cars, all red. God was telling me something. But excitement phases, like during this period of service where I really didn't have anything to do, I'd gone to the motor pool, learned how to drive everything, and it was my custom in my clinic to have a drink with the last patient. And they generally stayed a while, and they helped stay a while, and their husbands stayed a while, because we had an open bar. So this one night, I looked out the window, and this last patient was driving a new 18-wheel Peterbilt. And I had just bought a new red Jaguar XJ12 convertible. A few drinks, we swapped rigs. And that's how I inherited my Al-Anon, who after 10 years, we finally got married a couple of years ago. That's an experience. But my path into this program was very long. I finally drank enough to bust a gut, literally a diverticulum ruptured. But 2 days before this happened, my kids had all gone. I was living in this pad, and I had four bars in it. Living alone, I was dashed from my clinic, past my OU red van with a bar, run in the house and past the den with a bar, the sunroom with a bar, the swimming pool with a bar, and I was drinking straight cheap vodka in my closet. The insanity. So, one night as I had my second shot out of that jug, I smelled a familiar odor of tea rose perfume, and there stood my Al-Anon with great love and great fear, with an intervention of five words, "Mark, do you need help?" And I surrendered, my first step toward humility. A few days later, a few meetings later, my colon ruptured. I was 32 days unconscious in intensive care, dialysis, the whole works. Then sent to San Diego for recovery and to find out why me. After 28 days, I got the colostomy repaired. I stayed another 28 to find out why me. And then I stayed another 28, making three meetings a day. I have never had a problem with step 1 and with step 7. This humility got me started into finding out why me, my whole life of character defects, which I had elaborated on for over 30 years. This first meeting at IDAA was my turning point. My humility really began standing at Dr. Bob's grave when it all the panorama came together. And I found all these new friends. And my life now is more exciting than I ever dreamed it could possibly be. I outscored a little country boy from Tifton, Georgia, sit in California in Beverly Hills last November, where we had a little horse running in the Breeders' Cup, lean over to Elizabeth T., who was sharing Perrier, and said, "Thank you for meeting Bill Wilson." Where else could a person find these friends except for having all these character defects that led us into alcoholism, that led us into this beautiful program? And it's only with humility that we get rid of the character defects. We all share the same ones. I haven't heard any great variation off of any of these. Where else could we find that we can humbly ask him to remove the shortcomings? I had no him growing up. But I found out, even listening to Father Martin's tape, you know, when he talks about asking this God of our understanding to remove our shortcomings, we find out there this humility that God can and will if he is sought. So my defects still number a lot. Procrastination, putting off things, that's a big one. But we also carry out a 12-step program in my clinic that is fantastic. My whole crew is enthusiastic. We have a big question sheet, and it's got a lot of character defects on it that reminds us. And quite often we pop a couple of Anabuse in their tablets, lead them to a sponsor, stick it in their mouth, lead them to a sponsor, send them to a treatment center. It's all gratifying, and it's only because of all these character defects that we can give away. We can turn this whole thing over to God. And if I had to sum up the entire program, 6 and 7 really is the program. And the 7-step prayer is what releases us from the bondage. When we can say, "My Creator, I am now willing that you shall have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out here to do your bidding." This allows us to move out to help others and do 12-step work. Thank you.
Get it in that time. It won't be recorded. Thank you, Mark. I've been asked to discuss step 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Before I share with you my thoughts on that step, I'd just like to take a moment and, on behalf of my wife Sylvia and all the doctors in our group in Vancouver, British Columbia, who weren't able to come here, I'd like to thank the committee for putting on such a wonderful program. We had the opportunity of organizing the meeting in 1983 in Vancouver, and I can assure all of you that there's a tremendous amount of work involved in the background. Just the very program takes a lot of ideas and a lot of time to get everything down, to get the timings in, the speakers put in the right place. And I just have a feeling about this meeting and the way it's moving along, the comfort and the serenity that's here. And that's always a mark of a tremendous amount of organization that's gone into it. And so to the members of the committee that were responsible for this convention, I want to just offer up to you our thanks for making such a wonderful program available. How I got here was that approximately 9.5 years ago, the alcohol and drugs that I was taking caused me to have seizures and blackouts, took me into a treatment center or a jailhouse, and got me to a point where my life became so out of tune with what I believe God meant it to be, that I finally reached for help, and it's just been a glorious journey ever since. I related a great deal to what Jim had to say last night, that whatever he was asked to do, he did. And the two things that have gone so well with me or have been in my favor from the day that I realized there was an organization such as Alcoholics Anonymous that could take me out of the mess I was in was the opportunity of becoming comfortable with a loving God. And secondly, the great thing that's helped me in this program was that I've never had any problems in following what people have told me to do. With respect to step 8, I feel like Mark, that this is a package deal. I'm reminded of what it says in the 12 by 12, that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which practiced as the way of life, will relieve the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to be happy and usefully whole. The obsession to drink for me was relieved 20 minutes after 10 on February the 22nd, 1976. But in terms of being happy and usefully whole, that was a long time to come. Primarily because there was really no harmony in my life. Certainly wasn't with people and places and things. And it wasn't until I got to step 8 that I realized what that was all about. It took me steps 2 and 3 to be comfortable with a loving God. It took steps 4, 5, 6, and 7 to get an understanding of what I was all about. And then, as it tells me in step 8, as a result of knowing more about myself, I had the opportunity of developing the greatest possible relationships with other men and women. And for me, as it also says in step 8, that this learning process of developing the greatest peace and partnership and brotherhood with all men and women of whatever description has been a tremendous and exciting experience for me. But one thing I didn't know about the 8th step was I initially thought I knew what amends meant, and to me that was simply to seriously say I was sorry for any harms that I caused, whether that be physical, mental, spiritual, or emotional. But it wasn't until within the last 2 or 3 years that I've come to understand the word amends to mean a lot more than just saying I'm sorry, Charlie, or I'm sorry, Mary, for what I've done, and sincerely meaning it. To me, the word amends to me means sincerely changing my behavior and attitude toward you so that I will not repeat the behavior that I had in the past toward you. And that's what step 8 means to me. In terms of making a list, I had no problem with that, because I felt if that's what I was to do, then that's what I should do, and I did that. So step 8 hasn't been difficult for me at all. And as other speakers have mentioned, I set out to do this exactly the way it was printed in the 12 by 12. One of the people I had a great deal of difficulty coming to terms with a new definition of amends that I had now come to understand was my father. And that finally came about for me as a result of what I heard early on. And that is, Elmer, you have to pray for the people you dislike the most. I didn't dislike my father. I hated my father. That has since changed. And I don't think there's anyone, to my recollection, that I dislike today. As a matter of fact, I love everyone, and I didn't know what that word meant. And the word to me, love, means what my good friend Dr. John, or Dr. Paul from Seattle, says about love. Love to him and to me now means wishing someone well and be willing to help them achieve that. And that's what I would like for everyone, wishing everyone well and be willing to help them achieve that. And that's where I am today. I am in tune. I'm in harmony with people. I'm in harmony with the loving God that made me. And I'm in harmony with myself. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. In closing the meeting, I'd like to thank the speakers for sharing their thoughts on their respective steps. And also to all of you who came in and participated in this program by sitting in a chair and listening. I was going to, if we had time, ask for people to come up and share their thoughts on the steps, but we're out of time. And in closing this meeting, I would like you to stand, if you would, and say the Lord's Prayer.